All right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again. It is the Dom and Colin podcast, back talking more Survivor David versus Goliath. Today, the merge is in store for us. I am Colin, once again, here with Dom. Dom, long time no see, buddy.
I'm fabulous, in case you're wondering, as I often am, and I assume you are as well.
I am, and I wasn't wondering, because I know you're doing fabulously, because we actually just got off the line. We finished recording a very long podcast about making a murderer. I ran a little over 2.5 hours with special guests Dominic Abate and Chris Hammonds, and that's going to be coming soon, so be on the lookout for that. But suffice to say, I've already spent a bunch of time with Dom today, but very much looking forward, of course, as always, to spending even more with you now.
Well, that was a ton of fun, and I would say 2.5 hours is about median length for us. I don't know in any absolute sense what you'd call that, but in order that this one doesn't last 2.5 hours as well, let's get straight into this. So not as much to talk about as we often have with a merge episode, but still a fair amount to get to here.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And so, yeah, I'm with you. Let's dive into this. I think there's still plenty of really fun stuff. I think the season continues to deliver for pretty much everyone who's watching. Unless, I mean, I guess I have the perfect person to be asking right now if there's anyone who could find reasons to be disliking something as overwhelmingly popular as it seems like David versus Goliath has been. Dom, did you overall like this merge episode? Is this continuing the trend of a strong showing from this season?
Yeah, it was really good. And once again, I'm impressed by how much they managed to do with an outcome that on paper seemed to be fairly formulaic. You know, it's yet another unanimous or near unanimous merge vote. And you would think that would be pretty lackluster. They'd have to work hard to get anything exciting out of that. But once again, it's these characters who came through and really delivered, even if the gameplay itself was just by the book.
Right. One talking point that I know has gotten a lot of traction this week, and understandably so, you know, it's been 37 seasons, and this is actually the first time that we have a literally unanimous merge vote where only the person who got voted out had a vote on anyone else. But I think you flag up something interesting that is probably getting lost in that kind of fun statistic, which is it does seem like, especially since we've started merging with more and more people, pretty much all of the merge votes with right around 13 people aren't technically unanimous, but that's often because it's a lot of votes getting split to play around idols and so forth. And it does seem like this continues in what is kind of an underrated pattern in, frankly, fairly straightforward merge votes, which may seem counterintuitive given just the sheer volume of players at the merge.
Right. So I think we've had 5 merge votes with 13 people now. If you look back across those, you have Millennials versus Gen X, Michelle goes out. It seemed pretty clear cut that she was going there. Game Changers we had, doing a quick tally in my head here. Yeah, that was 13. And we have Ceri once again coming through on behalf of the audience by somehow switching this vote around, and Haley gets blindsided, which wasn't a phrase we expected to be uttering coming out of that episode. But
quick sidebar, I could not tell you anything about Haley ended up. I knew she was the merge vote. I have no memory of how that ended up coming to be.
I cannot tell you about anything involving Haley on that season. Like, all of it has been a firmly erased homecoming style from my memory.
I remember the "I don't consent," and that is essentially the only memory I have of Haley Ford on that season.
Yeah, she gave birth to one good meme and then disappeared for the rest of the season. But yeah, so that was, despite Ceri's best efforts, still a fairly straightforward merge vote. Yeah, Cambodia was the first one to do that, I believe, and they
right.
had
to Ruby save Joey Amazing and Savage. We have to merge early,
right? And Cass has to be the casualty there instead.
Casualty.
Anyway, Ghost Island, we have the infamous Chris Noble Boot episode, which was fantastic. We'll give credit there where it's due. But it's unclear if that was because it happened at exactly 13 people. I guess maybe if his tribe had gone to tribal again before the merge, then he could have been clipped, and then we'd need to get something else. But I think that excitement still could have been harnessed if we go into that merge with 12 people instead. So I don't think it worked to its benefit there. And then this time around, we have Elizabeth going home. That's what I think the smart money was on coming to the episode. Not sure what we predicted last week, but that's not where the smart money was anyway. So not putting too much stock in that. But it does seem like a trend that we see emerging here, that when you have more
emerging
and more
people, I promise I'll stop.
I don't believe you. I really don't. it does seem that in theory, this should be good, right? Because the post-merge portion of the game typically is more dynamic and more exciting, and certainly those early post-merge roads tend to be where the real action is. But I don't know if you can have too much of a good thing, and that when you have this extra post-merge vote, it doesn't feel like a post-merge vote, because even though you have all of the trappings, all the accoutrements of a merge episode, you got the merge feast, you got people meeting for the first time and so on, you get all of that fun stuff. But the vote itself, it often feels like a delaying tactic until the actual, until the knives come out and things actually start happening.
Right. It feels like, frankly, if I were to like try to psychoanalyze why that may be, I really think 13 people is just too many in under conventional kind of circumstances, like barring exceptional circumstances, for most people to feel like comfortable trying to pull off some big epic blindside when there are that many conversations happening all over the place. And I think even in like the all-star seasons that we've seen go through this, people tend to default when there's that much uncertainty onto just whatever is the safest. And while it may seem on the surface like having more people at the merge is inherently almost a better idea because it's just more permutations of possibilities, that is not the effect that merging people so early is actually having on the game. And I would actually, as surprised as I am to hear myself saying this in the year 2018, because I'm sure you could find recordings of me in 2011 talking about how stupid it is that they're not merging sooner and having more people make it there. I think we may be at the point where I would go so far as to say I'm becoming strongly in favor of pushing the merge back a bit again.
How far is that? Because I imagine you back in 2009, let's say, as 12-person merges were just starting to be a thing, you would have been saying, okay, this is a great development. We're finally getting what I've been asking for this whole time. And it seemed like initially that was working, that you had exactly the results that you would have predicted and hoped for. But now it's gone too far. So where is that threshold for you? Is it 12 versus 13, or should we take a page out of Heroes versus Villains and go back to a 10-person merge occasionally?
So I definitely don't think anywhere in this range, generally speaking, is too big of an issue. I don't mean to make it a mountain out of a molehill here and say that this is some kind of chronic problem for Survivor. And I do understand why they do this. It's very exciting, first of all, to just be in a post-merge setting versus a pre-merge setting. And I'm sure if we were podcasting about it and I had to actually sit through 2 months of a pre-merge, it may start to feel like it was dragging on a bit. But I would honestly say, without putting, you know, obviously a ton of thought into this, I think the magic number for me would be 11. I think 11 really opens the door just in a vacuum for a lot of really interesting possibilities, but is not so many people that people are going to be terrified. I feel like 11 could be a great number where people arrive in that kind of situation feeling like the game certainly has plenty of time left to go, but it is becoming more and more of an issue to make sure votes are going your way in an active sense rather than just not being bad for you, because crunch time is going to be here before you know it. Whereas with 13, it still has got to feel like there's a ton of game left to be played.
Is there some elaborate game theory reason that I'm sure Christian would happily lecture you about for why, let's say, 11 versus 13 is better, or why an odd number versus an even number is better for that vote in particular?
So for me, the reason I say 11 was the magic number is purely because 13 is, I think, just slightly too many. Maybe it's just a small sample size issue, and in the long run, 13 would be incredible, and we just haven't gotten to see that yet. I'm totally willing to acknowledge that's a possibility. 13, to me at this point, seems like too much. 9 seems like too few. And to get to the second thing you brought up, I think an odd number is pretty critical in having an exciting merge vote. Like, yes, you are going to occasionally have your Heroes versus Villains or your South Pacifics where you get this deadlock, and that's an awesome situation. And that's what happened in the early seasons. That was really exciting. But anything other than kind of a deadlock at an even numbered merge, I feel like is going to be way more straightforward than an odd numbered merge.
Okay, yeah, I think I can co-sign most of that. The last 11-person merge, I want to say, was co-wrong kind of by accident because you had all of these medevacs happening in just the right way to make that line up. But have they done that intentionally, at least in recent memory?
Yes, and I thought the words that you were going to say, and it was the only example I could think of, so good job by you. So apparently co-wrong merged at 11. But I do know the deliberate 11-person merge was in Philippines. I believe they merged with 11 people. They put Malcolm and Denise onto different tribes, played two or three more rounds, and then merged them with 11.
Yeah, and I was ready to jump in and fact check you, but from a quick glance at Wikipedia, it turns out that is actually true. So good job and good point, whatever your logic for it happens
awesome.
To be.
I'm glad I got the Daily Double right there. I Roger Craig'd it and wagered everything, so now I don't even know what I get. Whatever. We'll save the Jeopardy discussion for another time. We don't need to.
And we will actually save it this time, because I know back in 2014 or whatever, we pledged to have Jeopardy podcast at some point. We are energized to do that, and I'm sure we will find the motivation when that... Is it a Tournament of Champions or some like ultra mega showdown or something? When that finally rolls around, I'm sure we'll be on board.
Right. And when that does roll around, to get excited for it, just, I think I may have even mentioned this on a semi-recent podcast, but just to get jacked up for that, do yourself a favor and just go to YouTube and punch in Roger Craig Daily Double and watch the top clip that comes up, and you will get excited for that tournament, because that guy's going to be back and he's the absolute man. And I'm the Survivor podcasting equivalent of that, according to me, apparently, on this podcast. Dom, let's get to...
Hold on, does that make me the... Am I the Brad Rutter? Like, where do I fit into all of this?
You wish you were the Brad Rutter. I don't know what you are.
I really do. But that should be a lot of fun. And just to close out on this merged numbering point, I think with 13, when that's divided into two tribes, when you have more people than that, let's say you have 14 left in the game, it's almost easier to edit that in a cohesive way, because you have this clear division in terms of half the groups on this tribe, half the groups on this other tribe. So we're going to allot 15 minutes to this, 15 minutes to the other guys, and then one of the tribes is going to lose a challenge and we'll focus the rest of the episode on them. And that gives you a clear delineation of what you have to do. Whereas when you have them all together in one group, as once again, what no matter whether you put it in terms of factorials, exponents, whatever else, there are so many more combinations just of people on that same island together. And if you're dropping one person out of the mix entirely to make room for other things, then if that one person is crucial, then that's a whole web of storylines that collapses around with them.
Right.
So you have to at least make an effort to give screen time to a lot of people, but that's hard to do, and it's hard to balance. And we see your Favy Davy gets lost in the shuffle here, basically completely invisible for the entire episode, much to your chagrin, I'm sure, and to many other people's as well.
Yeah, and just quickly for the official record, I'm going to say... Paul Osselson is the Brad Rutter of Survivor podcasters. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think Mario is the Ken Jennings, and Mike and Jay can fight it out for who gets to be the Roger Craig.
Sure.
Okay. Let's get to this merge and how this all comes about, Dom. The green team is hanging out at their beach, enjoying some coffee, when two boats pull up with some new people who are going to join them, and we are officially going to be the merge. We're officially at the merge now, as Allison, of all people, is going to be laying out for us in the confessional, the kind of obligatory, hey, I'm so excited, it's the merge now, confessional. Did you make anything of Allison being the person to get that? Because while not wanting to venture too far into the edit zone, I think it is fair to say that probably came as a surprise to a lot of people, considering the lack of narration she seemed to be getting to this point.
Yeah, it's not surprising for her to get the completely generic exposition confessional that moves the plot very slightly forward. I imagine that alliance of six that we see band together that involves her and some of the Davids, and I imagine that's going to be a fairly crucial plot point a few episodes down the line. So they're laying the groundwork for that now, and whether that means it goes well for her or she gets blindsided or whatever role she ends up playing, just getting that brief introduction to her now just eases people in, given that she was surprisingly invisible for the first half of the season. And I was disappointed about that. I know all the people who had her as their preseason picks, I were disappointed too. But it seems like she's kind of coming into her own now. She's in this six-person alliance that's poised to strike first, if you will. She won the challenge this episode, and it seems like edit-wise, she's finally appearing, which is a welcome change. So it seems like everything's coming up Allison, excuse me, at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Allison is a great case of something we see on Australian Survivor, and I really wish the U.S. editors would do more of this, and maybe Allison is their kind of trial run in America at this sort of thing, where it's not going to be an issue for the bulk of the audience who's just tuning in on a Wednesday night. It doesn't cross their mind who they're not seeing when they're watching the early episodes. If Allison doesn't pop up until episode 5, the casual viewer is not going to care that they weren't there for the early episodes by the time the merge rolls around. And maybe an extreme version of that is like, Allison, it really does seem like is more popping up episode 6 and 7. And I'm guessing as it now looks like she's going to be part of this Strike Force majority alliance. It looks like she could be around for a little while longer. I think Allison could be a great example of like, it doesn't matter if you don't show us a ton of someone early on. We are happy to acknowledge they weren't that relevant early on. And now once their position becomes more central to the game, we're happy to start learning about them now.
And likewise, you might be screaming at your TV and throwing your discarded vape pens around in anger at Davey not showing up. But for the people who aren't taking an active interest in Davey, they're not losing out on anything. They don't know what they're missing.
Right. Well, they should know what they're missing by now, because Davey is, of course, taking the nation by storm every Wednesday night to this point. But yeah, absolutely, that I don't think it's going to be a big issue for anyone if we show up next week and Davey starts playing a more prominent role in the episode. I don't think that's going to throw off even the most casual of viewers. I don't think they're going to be asking themselves, wait a minute, why didn't I see anything of Davey last week during the merge? But all right, let's get to something that Gabby is quite astute to notice. And that is when they arrive at the merge and they have the feast all spread out for them, there's a plaque or a sign, or I don't know how to describe it, that says, hey, congratulations, everything you need for the perfect merge is right here. And Gabby says, well, hey, couldn't that mean some sort of idol or advantage is also right here? That seems to be something that they go back to from time to time over the course of Survivor history, tossing something in at the merge. And Dom, that brings us to an email we got this week from Jeff Dawson, because we get this confessional from Gabby and we don't actually see anything followed up on that. So Jeff writes, do you think it was significant that Gabby was shown at the merge feast with a confessional about how she was looking for an idol clue, but then didn't actually find anything? Is this supposed to show us that she has strategic chops and is playing the game hard, even though she isn't actually able to find a clue? Obviously, it makes sense why they would show such a confessional before a contestant actually finds the clue or the idol, but why spend precious airtime if one isn't going to be found, and why choose Gabby to be the one giving this confessional, as I'm also sure other people have been looking for the clue at the very least? And then Jeff closes this email by saying, thanks for the show, and I not only enjoy Survivor more because of you guys, I have also become a big fan of Survivor Maryland and the genius. Jeff, you are doing the Lord's work. Fantastic email. Dom, what do you think about Gabby and her potential significance as it pertains to what appears to be an inevitable merge kind of idol or advantage that's out there?
So to go to the question that Jeff asked, why spend precious airtime if nothing's going to be found? The answer, in theory, I guess, would be if you only show that kind of confessional when the idol is about to be found, then you're just preempting yourself. And instead of building up anticipation and excitement for that big moment, that big reveal, you just deflate it before it even happens. So you might want to balance your range, I guess, a bit more by feigning people out and having those bluffs in there sometimes. But I think that runs up against the cold, hard reality that you only have so much time to work with, and you're not going to waste that time on maybe having that bluff in there when you could just do it outright and move on to the next thing. So with Gabby, I do think it is significant. I don't know what it signifies in this case. I think there are lots of different ways that could go. But it plays into this perception of Gabby, or this self-image, I guess, of that Gabby has as wanting to be this more confident player and being aware and trying to validate her own fandom of the game by having these concrete achievements, whether that's doing well in challenges or surviving a certain number of votes, making it to these signpost points in the game, and finding an idol and doing it by solving this clue and knowing to look for that clue. That's one of those things you tick off the bucket list as a Survivor fan who makes it onto the show eventually.
Right. Even though she hasn't found it yet, I'm sure she did get a lot of points from a lot of fans for just thinking on that level and people liking to see that kind of initiative. Now, I saw someone tweeting about this, and of course, as usual, I don't remember whom to credit here, but I thought it was an interesting observation that if we think back to, I guess it must have been in the premiere or right around there in one of those early episodes, Angelina, when they're off idol hunting, gives the confessional about how it's such a disparity in gender balance between historically finding idols, and we're going to do something to change that this season. And now currently we're here at the Merge with yet another situation where there are three idols out there and all of them are owned by men. I guess Dan has two of them, but still have not seen anything come of potentially a woman doing something to kind of restore something to that balance. So I'm going to ask you, Dom, first of all, Gabby against the field for who gets this advantage. And then second of all, a woman against the field for who gets this advantage.
Huh. So I thought you were bringing that up because we did actually see that faint out on the season with Angelina, where when she starts going off on the statistics of how many women have found idols versus men, I thought clearly this is a setup to her or some other woman. Like maybe she'll give voice to that and then it's going to be Natalia or someone who finds it instead. But then Dan swoops in and finds it and then finds another one, and then Davey's off finding his in the meantime. And I thought that was just going into this amazing storyline they set up with Angelina of her being very confident about things and then being very wrong about all of them at the same time.
Ah.
From what you're saying, it sounds like you think there's some continuity between what she said there and Gabby being the one to maybe take advantage of this.
Right. I think I am at the point, especially I noticed on rewatch, it wasn't only the sign that had the picture of where the idol is hidden. And for the record, in case anyone hasn't seen this, the sign that said, "Congratulations, everything you need for a perfect merge is right here," featured it as it seems like it's just kind of like a tropical design to make it look island and festive and whatever. It's a picture of a very kind of askew tree, almost at like a 45-degree angle hanging off of a beach. And then there's a shot later in the episode. I saw this on Twitter. I know whom to credit here. It was DJ LaBelle Klein was, I believe, one of the first ones to notice on Twitter. That tree is a tree that's on the beach. And that it is taken, I would suspect, correctly at this point as gospel that picture of this crooked tree is the idol clue. And if you put two and two together, you will understand that tree is where you need to be digging. And that picture was not only on the sign that welcomed to the merge, it was also that exact same picture on all of like the napkin holders that they cut to when Gabby was talking about looking in the napkins. And I think Gabby is going to be the one who puts two and two together. And at this point, I would say I will take Gabby against the field to get whatever is buried underneath that tree.
Yeah, that tree is not orthogonal, as it turns out. It very clearly sticks out, and I think that X, or whatever shape it makes, does mark the spot. Anyone who figures it out and looks at that from the right angle will know instantly that they found the right place.
Well, crucially, just kind of to... Sorry to cut you off, but I thought it was interesting... Yeah, right. But I have to say that to make it seem like I am. I thought it was interesting that the clue... And this is the thing that I would never, ever, ever be able to get past. And I guess that kind of makes it sound like I'm taking credit for being a really heads-up Survivor player. But if I was out there and I saw the clue that said, "Congratulations, everything you need for a perfect merge is right here!" exclamation point, I wouldn't even necessarily think twice about it. But that's not the style here. What it says is, "Congratulations, everything you need for a perfect merge is right here, dot, 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 exclamation point right at the base of that tree on the picture."
So the actual like placing of the font on the page is
it's the dot dot dot, right. The ellipses or whatever that gets me.
Yeah, that's almost like a trail on a map, right? Where it's like you have to follow this path or something. Yeah, so that's all the clues are adding up. And I think Gabby will be the one to put all of those together and decipher it. I was confused though when they said everything you need for a perfect merge is right here. I didn't know, is Natalie Cole about to jump out of a cake or something? Like there seems to be a crucial missing ingredient that they're not recognizing.
That's right. I'm not going to sully any more of these podcasts with my Natalie Cole takes. So I'm just going to agree with you and move on from there. But
you can move on. I will remain on this briefly. Okay. Because so that clue, when I saw that at first, I thought, okay, so this physical location where we're seeing this, maybe that she's going to have to like dig underneath a table or something when people aren't looking, or it's going to be in this actual location where they're all gathered. And then I know people were speculating in real time when we don't have the ability to like look back and rewatch all the footage that, oh, it seemed like it was placed at this weird angle where if you put your hand behind it, maybe there's a piece of parchment or something like that. But I'm more inclined to think that you're right. The first step in that process, whether it's the clue itself or the idol itself, or a clue to maybe it's hidden at a challenge or whatever, that first step is going to be at the base of that tree or around, you know, underneath the rocks there or somewhere over there instead.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about it. I thought putting the image not only on that sign but also on the napkin holders, I thought was them really trying to signal, hey, look at this, pay attention to this, and I'm going to be really interested in seeing, I'm guessing it's Gabby, but whoever it is coming up with that and kind of having a moment not entirely unlike things we would see on The Genius, of like people getting to do the math in real time, sometimes quite literally on The Genius doing the math in real time, and seeing them kind of have that aha moment where they put it all together. I'm very much looking forward to like the back half of what I expect to be kind of a two-part Gabby figures all this out kind of saga.
And I do think that will happen. However, the one thing that gives me pause is Gabby's confessional as all of this is happening is, quote, "This could be survivor paranoia, where you look for a sign in everything when there's not one." And if I was an editor, I would definitely just slip in that half a second shot of Angelina and co. walking past that tree and having that tree on screen, because I know it's guaranteed to send people like us into a frenzy of speculation, and this is going to be the big talking point on the internet for the next week. And that seems like a good use of screen time when it's less than a second, and you get to just like throw this cheeky ploy in there.
I very much question the idea that the editors are ever doing anything just to like mess with the 0.001% of us who read way too much into this.
Right, but that 0.001% of us are so annoying to them that I wouldn't fault them at all for just putting the middle finger up in that way.
Oh, I certainly wouldn't either. But not only that, I mean, I feel like our whole thing as it pertains to how we wish the editors would treat us is, I feel like we've been saying since day one of this podcast, do it to us. Please go out of your way to mess with us. Like, throw in compelling decoys.
So maybe they're finally listening and giving us what we want.
Yeah, hey, mission accomplished. I'm good doing business with you. We can shut it all down now.
I'm trying to be the optimistic one here. I'm sorry.
All right. So we are now one big happy merge tribe. And one thing I thought was interesting is as they're all having their merge feast, we see Carl breaking down to Angelina the way that the vote ended up going down, where Alec flipped on which Goliath did Alec flip on? I'm already not remember thank you on Natalia's. I knew it wasn't Natalie, but I knew it was something like that. And it is presented on TV like this is shocking breaking news to Angelina and the rest of the Goliaths, but I swear when the episode after that aired and they all showed up to the beach and everyone got their obligatory shocked faces about, oh, Natalia now no longer with the Purple Tribe, I could have sworn Kara made some pretty overt kind of physical motion that we got to see on screen, kind of like shrugging like, hey, it wasn't me. And even if she didn't, what did these people think happened to Natalia other than Alec flipping? Like, how could this have been such a big shock to Angelina and company?
Yeah, unless Natalia just quit or something. There's really only one other option that makes sense. So that was weird. And also, the way that Angelina framed it as well was, well, Alec must have just made this emotional move to flip on the Goliaths, and he's not looking to the future. This is irrational and short-sighted. When she also was part of flipping on a Goliath member and potentially reducing their numbers going into the merge. And I'm sure if you asked Angelina about that, she would give you a very logical and seemingly sensible explanation as to why that made sense. But I'm sure Alec could do that too, even if the way he phrased it might be a little different. So it seems like the classic, like, almost empathy problem of, well, my moves are well thought out and make a lot of sense, and your moves are not calculated whatsoever, and I'm so much better than you, and so on and so forth, and everything that comes with that.
Right, if you were thinking in your best interest, you would do what I want.
Of course, yeah. And see, I like where Angelina's coming from this episode, because it feels so corporate in a way. It's very much about, okay, let's sit down and actually have a sensible discussion and we'll hash things out. And when no one is doing that, because that's never how Survivor works, it's almost like they've committed some cardinal sin against the game and against her, and she just, like, takes umbrage at that. So I'm loving Angelina so far, and I thought this was going to be the end of Angelina's story, and it would have been a great end to it, but I'm glad that we get to see her try and wrestle her way back up from the bottom now, however she ends up trying that.
Right. I loved a couple of scenes, actually, from both of which included Angelina. Some editing choices that I really enjoyed. One, you described it as like a corporate environment. The way it, at least in the back half of the episode, is everyone's like scrambling before the vote, and everyone, you know, the Goliaths are all powwowing on the beach, and Angelina's trying to make sure everyone's on the same page. Rather than corporate, they really present it in a military kind of style, and they use like the drums, the military kind of marching drums in the background that I loved that choice to throw in there. And I feel like that's something they wouldn't have done even as recently as a few years ago. I could be wrong about that. There are certainly plenty of fun editing choices, don't get me wrong, from all eras of Survivor. But I also loved in the scene of Angelina where she's telling Elizabeth, hey, the hit's out on you. It shows like Elizabeth approaching in the woods, and for, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 seconds, they just cut out all background music that is almost always present on Survivor, and you just don't even hear it at a certain point. You just get used to it, and it's really not until it's gone that it really stands out, and they remove it for the beginning of that scene, and I thought that was so effective.
The show is, it's so sleek and fast-paced nowadays that whenever they linger on anything, or whenever they take out one of those essential background ingredients, it always stands out that much more. And if they did it all the time, then it would lose its effect, obviously. But I love it when they do decide to do it, and they judiciously choose when to do that, and it just lands so well. And yeah, I agree here. It works so perfectly here.
Yeah. So, I mean, I gather from hearing you talk about this, do I get the sense, Dom, that you are becoming a bit of a Stangelina, or were you ready to see her go because you are excited about her meeting a downfall?
Oh, I could take either option at this point. I love to love Angelina, and I love to hate Angelina at the same time. She is TV gold, and it's just, she is such a great casting choice, because whatever happens to her, I'm here for. If it's her somehow succeeding in scrambling her way back up, is going to be great. And if it's some dramatic downfall, that's fine too. I'll happily sign up for anything.
Right. I feel like, honestly, this episode really stands out to me. Like, we see people get, you know, the edit not always be kind to everyone on Survivor, but I cannot imagine a world where Angelina was really coming across to her alliance mates the way it seems like they want us to feel she is coming across on the TV show.
So you think they see her as more competent and more included than she's coming across, or the reverse?
Correct. Okay. Yeah. I think they see her not only as more competent, but particularly as things pertain to this episode, I'm sure they viewed her as wanting to have her opinions heard, but I feel like this episode is unambiguously trying to make her look just bossy and uninterested entirely in anyone else's.
Oh yeah,
opinion.
This episode buries her, absolutely. And I think she gave them enough material to do that with, but I don't know if her surviving the episode is a sign that actually in practice she is more well-respected and her voice is being heard. I think it's more just the case that all of this happened at the last minute, and there's no reason to turn on Angelina now when you could just take out the person who has no connection with anybody, as we've seen so often, time and time again, with RC, with Cass, with all of these people who get isolated at the merge, and then you can start trimming the fat and eating your own later on. And when that happens, Angelina might be the first to go.
Right, right. That's exactly what I was going to say, is we hear Christian set up the strike force in terms of them being this tactical unit that when the time is right, they're going to be deployed and parachute down and take out a high value target. I would say Angelina is probably my front runner to be that target, like the first big hit by the strike force when they finally reveal themselves.
I have to think by now, news of Angelina targeting Christian must have got back to him. So if the strike force does assemble and Angelina's right about how threatening and dangerous Christian is, then she might be proven right by his choice of target of her and his ability to get her out when they finally make that move.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I honestly, at the point, even though we don't see someone as overtly conventionally threatening as I would say John is, like I don't know how you could draw up someone that once the merge rolls around, people would, a random Survivor level one or level two thinker would be more intimidated by than someone like John. But I could easily see if Strikeforce saying, okay, we have a clean look tonight at whoever else we want to take out. I think Angelina makes more sense to take out than John, and I could see people getting on board.
And Angelina is right about Christian versus Elizabeth, because Elizabeth, even among the other Davies that are also outcast along with her, she doesn't have any sway with them. Carl seemed enthusiastic to get her out. We heard nothing from Davy, but I assume he was on board with it too. And the Davies who are doing their best to work their way up in the ladder don't want to be saddled with Elizabeth. So everyone's on board with her going. Whereas Christian, everyone seems to love the guy. And he gets his pick of the litter, basically, in who he wants to work with. So she's right insofar as he is a much bigger threat. But that's because of the people that she's pitching that idea to, some of them want to work with Christian. That's what makes him dangerous. So it's right. A tough thing to sell, and I guess you have to do it in a different way than Angelina did. I don't know what that way would look like necessarily, but it's clear that her approach just wasn't working with them. And for as much as you would want that approach to work, it seems like it was sensible. She was presenting logical arguments. It's a case of perception as reality, right? Like if it's not working with them, then it's just not working.
I feel like Angelina could be a really strong historic case in when she loses, she looks really overbearing potentially. And when she wins, I could see her getting in that timeline, like one of the most glowing winner edits we've ever seen. Like I don't think they would have had a difficult time at all making Angelina look right on top of this merge vote and hitting all the right notes with her alliance to make sure that this went perfectly in the timeline where she won. And I just, the fact that we're not seeing anything close to that, obviously is going to send some red flags out my way. But I really feel like Angelina, is not necessarily getting the credit. I'm not trying to say, oh, Angelina is Spradlin-esque. As inclined as I may be to make such claims about other players, in situations where the evidence may not always be there. I really do firmly believe that under different circumstances, and maybe things will change, but I really feel like even potentially Angela 2.0 could look a lot better.
I agree, but I don't know what that cast looks like where she emerges as that Spradlin-esque Vector, because I think the difficulty is for her approach to work, the other people all need to be on her level. But if they are on her level, then that's much tougher competition. And in that cast, which supposedly is perfect for her personality and her playstyle, then she's going to have a much harder time of it just by virtue of how tough the competition is.
Yeah, I guess what I'm just getting at is I feel like Angelina, the point is, I think she's like historically at the mercy of the editors, just kind of given her personality and her play style. But I don't necessarily think that this time around we're getting the full picture.
It's almost like she's a reverse Russell Hantz, where the Russell problem is his play style relies on this emotional browbeating and manipulation and just grinding people into the dust until they submit to him, which tactically is very strong, but it means that when he gets to the end, they despise him and they're not inclined to reward him. And I think Angelina's game is similarly self-sabotaging, say that three times quickly, but maybe in a slightly different way, where, you know, if she's going to succeed in a cast, it's because there are 19 other Angelinas out there with her, and there's no reason why this particular Angelina is going to succeed over any of the others who are as good at anticipating their opponent's moves and working against them and rallying the troops and so on.
Get me Angelina on the genius. Get me the Angenius Alina. Sorry. All right. I can't do it anymore.
And yet here you are.
and yet he persisted.
Yeah. I would say get Angelina on The Apprentice. Rest in peace. If that show was still on, I think she would be a shoo-in for that. But I don't know if that approach, I'm sure it does work in the real world. I don't know if it works in the artificial bubble that Survivor is.
Yeah, Angelina, I realized the other day, is easily the leading contender of these last several seasons for person who 3 years from now, Colin Stone is going to be positive as a lawyer.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
She's passed the bar in three states as far as I'm concerned.
Lest we forget, this weird game of telephone came about because of Carl, who I was in love with Carl when he was sober, but drunk Carl is on another level entirely. And
wild Carl, bitches. Yeehaw, yeah. Kids.
And I've been saying for a long time, we need more drunk merch feasts. Just get them absolutely hammered and just let the camera, and just give us the raw footage. That can be the episode of 40 minutes of them completely drunk out of their minds at the merch feast. And that's a solid Survivor episode, even by merch episode standards.
I totally am with that. And yeah, I loved it. We saw a little bit of Carl sober coming after Elizabeth and then drunk coming even harder after Elizabeth. But I loved seeing Carl getting it in there. Really seemed to be no real kind of reservations at all about, even though his position looks a bit precarious at the merge, ostensibly down 7-6, he right away, it seemed like, was the person, maybe even above all others, at least on the TV show, who was in there really looking to mix things up. And that totally took me by surprise, but I absolutely loved it. And I'm so excited for Carl. And on a side note, related to what you were saying, I'm rooting for Carl's team in every single reward challenge so he can go get whatever alcohol they have there.
I hope Carl is perpetually wasted for the rest of his, the remaining 21 days or whatever it is.
I feel like Fair Play has set a high bar for highest number of days spent on Survivor drunk. I think on Pearl Islands, they got like a treasure chest that had whiskey in it or something. Maybe that was on All Stars, or maybe it was on both. But Fair Play spent plenty of his days on the island hammered there. And frankly, that really is an oversight. Like, there needs to be more alcohol on these kind of rewards, and more specifically, like, somehow find ways to get the whole camp drunk at the same time. Like, if you want to mix up an otherwise potentially stale political situation, that seems like what better way without running the risk of allegations of production interference or things like that. It seems like just throw in a few bottles of wine and that'll get the job done a lot of the time. But maybe it's like a physical health situation where when they're eating 400 calories a day, they can't really just drown them in liquor.
Jeff should issue a standing offer that anyone can just trade in valuable items for alcohol at any time. So, because there's going to be a tribe that is going to just hand in their tarp for a few bottles of wine, and then those people are going to get drunk and be fun to watch. And the people who are furious at them for giving away their shelter just to get drunk for the day are going to be mad too. So it's really just a recipe for success, whatever way you slice it.
I mean, I remember at that Philippines auction, Malcolm was in such a precarious spot. And we said in the podcast before, like, Malcolm and Denise, no matter what you do, don't spend a dime. You got to sit on all your money and get that advantage. First item up for bids. First $20, get this beer. Malcolm, hand cannot go up fast enough. And he's immediately down to 480. I feel like he would have traded one of those hidden immunity idols in for like a bottle of Jameson. Like, that's the level of alcoholic.
And I'm sure
is.
Denise watching that could have used a drink as well, even if she had to pay for it.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure Malcolm still got whatever that advantage was. Like, there, it was a long time. I think it was Cagayan, right? Where Spencer and Tony, like, breaking the auction and both saying, no, I'm going for 500 and I guess we'll draw rocks.
If you can read the room and you know you'll have your cake and eat it too, or drink it too, I guess, then why not? Just go for it.
No, I mean, listen, you won't meet a bigger proponent for thin value than me right here. If you can get that $20 beer, then by all means, if you're coming up with the advantage as well. But it's just crazy to think back in the day, like, I remember Cochran got the advantage for somewhere like in the 300s on Karamoan, and then the more glaring examples probably go back even further before people were really literate about what was even going on. For instance, like Danny Boatwright getting the advantage in Guatemala that was just like a free immunity necklace. I don't know the exact dollar amount, but it certainly wasn't anywhere close to the entire bankroll.
Right. So to close on all of this, thank you, Jeff Dawson, for your email. And because you forgot the segue that you put in the notes, I'll pick up the ball and run with it. Thank you for becoming a fan of Survivor Maryland, of which coverage will start hopefully in a few weeks once we've had the chance to rewatch it properly and schedule all of that.
Right. Yeah, very much looking forward to a lot of Survivor Maryland podcasting coming up. That we had so much going on with the new season of Survivor kicking off and Heroes versus Villains every week and other intermittent podcasts in there. But we are both in the process of rewatching Survivor Maryland All-Stars. And I know, I'm sure every listener, or certainly every regular listener, has heard us talk about how mandatory it is to check out Survivor Maryland many, many times. But for those of you still holding out, let's make it one more. You absolutely must watch Survivor Maryland, and then we have a ton coming along those lines very soon, so be excited for that. Dom, one person that's come up a little bit, but I want to get into further here now. We see Christian, your boy, reuniting here with Nick and their alliance that shall not be named on this podcast ever again. We find out that they're still feeling good about each other. Nick goes so far as to tell Christian about Dan potentially having an idol, and Christian's very excited that his buddy Nick is filling him in, and he's in the loop. And, oh, how exciting is this? It's a piece of wood. Isn't that fantastic? And I loved that confessional and the willingness to leave that in there. What did you think about Christian at this
when
merge?
He reunited with Nick, they had that brief awkward pause at the start where it's like, oh wait, we're on camera, and wait, what did we call our alliance again? And they knew they had to go through the motions before they actually got into the meat of what they were saying. But yeah, I'm over the Mason Jason alliance at this point. I am not over the Thoroughbreds, which we sadly lost this episode. Rest in peace, Thoroughbreds. If anyone knows where I can get a t-shirt or any other merch, let me know. I'll happily refurnish my entire wardrobe with that. But luckily, we still have 5 or 6 other alliances for Nick to carry on and for the rest of us to enjoy for the rest of the season.
So here is an offer that I will make to you. I don't know if you're going to say yes to this, but I can at least, I suppose, put it out there and open the door for this possibility. Dom, I can't imagine you've ever, certainly not owned, but I would be surprised if you've ever worn a cowboy hat in your life. I will buy you a cowboy hat if you will wear it to the next Live Know-It-Alls event.
I'm in.
Okay, you got it. You get a cowboy hat. So that'll be very exciting. And yeah, I'm with you. I very much continue to like Christian and feel good about the way he's playing and his spot in the game. And it really does seem to me like Christian is going to be someone we should probably get used to. It seems like, you know, certainly the timeline could exist where we show up next week and everyone does start listening to Angelina and they recognize what a big threat Christian has become. But as we've talked about just in passing a couple times to this point, but it's worth reiterating, it really seems like pretty much everyone likes Christian and wants to work with him as things stand right
and
now.
And ditto for Nick as well. So it's interesting that the two most well-connected players socially, and there's some overlap between that. So I know Nick has his thing with Mike, and he had a thing with Elizabeth, although that never seemed to amount to anything. Christian has Gabby and so on. And so far, to correct myself, I guess it's not really overlapping, but now as it starts to, there might be this tug of war between them for those votes down the line. And if they each recognize that the other one is playing the same kind of game and trying to do the same kind of thing, then they're going to feel the need to strike first. And so it might be not Christian and John or whatever else. It might be Christian and Nick that ends up being one of the big showdowns of the post-merge later.
Yeah, the vibe I'm getting is not one of, okay, we're going to be BFFs and go to the finals together necessarily. I think they both are recognizing how much sense it makes to come together for at least the next several rounds. But I'm guessing it's probably much more like a Dom and Wendell kind of situation where they each recognize, okay, at a certain point, we're going to need to cut each other because clearly you're my biggest threat out here compared to all of the other people that we're out here with. I feel like that compared to a lot of what tends to be the tightest alliances seem to say, no matter what happens, we'll just go to the finals together. I really feel like the new school approach to Survivor is that Dom and Wendell or that Christian and Nick kind of recognition of how much sense it makes in the moment to use our powers for good and combine them and take control of the game and put both of us in a position to win much more easily than we would by trying to gun for each other right away.
My question for you is, do you find Nick convincing and Nick's ability to just hypnotize people into wanting to work with him, does that make sense to you? Has that been adequately explained?
I will say yes, but I'm going to guess that your answer is no, given the framing of the question.
It's no for now because it doesn't jump through the screen at me. It's not like the Kim Spratton effect where the moment we just saw her is like, okay, yeah, I get it now. And I can't fault anyone out there for falling madly in love with her because I already have and I'm watching this from behind a screen. Whereas with Nick, he seems like a pleasant enough guy and someone who you would want to work with on Survivor, but not like every single person's guaranteed number one ally till the end of time, which it seems like he's occupying at the moment.
Well, okay, so I think what makes Kim Spradlin Kim Spradlin is just she is impeccable at never having any kind of like social faux pas or whatever, and a huge piece of Survivor is going, playing good or, in Kim's case, like historic great Survivor. But just if you're aiming to play good Survivor, a big piece of that is being able to make it 39 days while minimizing the number of just unforced social errors you make along the way, just small offhand comments that, for whatever reason, fairly or unfairly, rub the people around you the wrong way. And the vibe I get from Nick is that he is doing a good job of limiting
Yeah,
that.
it feels like he's just playing the game almost on easy mode, where his default setting of just being nice to people is better than enough people by a large enough margin that he's going to be one of the favorites to win just anyway, just by showing up.
So he's Nick Woosin.
Sure.
His last name's Wilson, right?
If you have to explain the joke, Colin, it's
I don't know. I'm asking because I don't know. I was asking because I may have just made a joke. I guess like I full disclosure, I went to high school with a kid named Nick Wilson, so I was wondering if I made that up and was like replacing him
It
with
is Nick
that.
Wilson, I'm pretty sure. But
Okay, good.
regardless.
So let me explain the rest of the joke. Woo was someone who. All right.
So I don't find it convincing yet, but we also haven't seen anyone else say, "This is why I love Nick so much." There's no confessional of people gushing about how great Nick is. It feels like he's just there by people's sides, and maybe that's less strong than we're being led to believe at the moment, and when that finally gets tested, they'll choose somebody else instead. But for now, it seems like everybody just relies on Nick and is counting Nick as one of their, if not their closest ally.
Yeah, I remember in the premiere we got Nick telling his whole tribe after spending some time to think it over, he decided he wanted to give them the scoop on his backstory and kind of the troubles that he's had in his own like personal life. But since then, have we heard too much about like Nick the person, or furthermore, I guess about like Christian the person? And if not, does that concern you at all?
It would concern me a little, but I think once you've had your quota for the season of that personal development, they don't feel the need to ladle that much more on top of that, unless it's for a specific purpose which hasn't really come up yet.
Well, I mean, I would say in that purpose is when it's Ben Driebergen or Jeremy Collins and they have little kids at home, and that is obviously not the case for Nick
He
and
could lie
Christian.
about it. He could say he does. I mean, that's certainly in his range. But I'm sure if he makes it to the family visit, there's going to be something around that, or they can find reason enough to make us care about Nick as a person if they're so inclined.
Yeah, and I would say kind of like what I was getting at when talking about Allison and her edit earlier. There's still so much time left, particularly I would imagine for both Nick and Christian, where it does not matter at all to the casual fan if we spend the entire season not mentioning anything about any of these people's personal lives. As long as something gets brought up in the finale, that's all it takes to get them on their side in the
And just
finale.
to jump in, I know last week we spent most of the episode just peppering edit takes in there without secluding it to his own zone, his own sandbox, and we'll try to get back to that model. And I know we haven't fully lived up to that this week, but rest assured, that is still our philosophy going forward, because we know people do appreciate well, the people who don't appreciate the edit talk appreciate it being sequestered elsewhere where they don't have to listen to it.
Sure. Yeah. I would. I don't think it's much of a an edit zone spoiler to say Nick and Christian will come up again in the
Yes.
edit zone. So I don't know. Do you have anything else on them that is pertinent right now?
I guess to tie up all of those loose ends, I know I joke about the Thoroughbreds alliance and that meaning its untimely demise, but Nick has so many of these just side alliances that some of those are guaranteed not to come to fruition. Are we meant to read anything into that, or is it just a natural consequence of the type of game he's playing, where if you're allied with seven different people and there were three seats in the finals, then some of those people are going to have to get clipped early, and there's not much that you or they can do about it?
Yeah, I think we're meant to read into Nick out there playing hard, and as far as pretty much everything would lead me to believe at this point, playing really effectively. I feel like it is surprising how much of Nick and his named side alliances we've seen, particularly the Thoroughbreds, which nothing really ever came of. I guess it was important for the first episode, but obviously didn't come up too much in Elizabeth's favor here this round. It is to me just I guess evidence essentially in the case for Nick.
And I bring up that example because it kind of reminded me of in Nicaragua when Alina at the merge episode, she learned just before the vote that that she was guaranteed to go, basically, and there's nothing she could do about it. And we see her making this last minute pitch to Fabio, and that kind of came out of left field, because as far as we knew, the two of them didn't really have any kind of relationship. If anything, she looked down on him a bit, so to see her pleading to him to guarantee her safety just seemed weird. And it seemed like that was like, clearly she was going to be the one to go. There was no doubt for them or for us about that, and that seemed like a way to garnish Fabio with some kind of strategic content, because that's not typically his mode of being, you know. That's not what he's feeding you naturally. So in this case, I would have thought, like, maybe we would see Elizabeth going to Nick, who is the one person that she's been flagged up as having this alliance with, now that Liz is gone, you know, that's her one connection. And instead, we kind of get a substitute with that for in Angelina coming to her to try and butter her up for a jury vote. But it's weird that thread just got severed abruptly, and there just nothing ever came of it ever again.
Yeah, I do agree with that. Although, again, I think it was just Nick is out there playing hard, and as far as we are probably meant to be believing, at least to this point, doing a good job at that. And I'm not sure what it seems like with both Christian and Mike. Those are going to be storylines that end up sticking. So I'm guessing we're going to see some more on both of those fronts soon.
Yeah. Speaking of people who are reaching out to Christian, can we talk about Alec quickly? Because Alec, I'm in love with Alec, and he had a fantastic episode here.
I totally agree with you. Actually, I got a tweet immediately after the episode that I was fully on board with. I know I was Hirsa for Lyrsa, and that Davey is my favy.
Oh, God.
But shout out to Nick Thomas for bringing to my attention the idea of being a Palak of Alec.
that's cheap, but that's fine. We'll go with it.
I loved it. I thought it was great. I am officially a Palak of Alec for sure.
I want to work something in with like rollicking and Alec, but I just can't make it work. There's no time to get that going, sadly.
And here's a fun fact for you, Dom. Probably not going to be that surprising now that you're starting to get a bit more context about this person. But Alec is, as far as I can tell, by far, Casual Anna's favorite player of the season.
Story, no story has ever checked that more, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. She very much into Alec here. But yeah, no, I'm loving Alec, and I feel like these last couple of weeks have been huge for Alec. It seems like I thought this guy we're not seeing that much of. I'm sure I was doing some stereotyping very cruelly about this, you know, young 20s bartender from, I think he's from Colorado or whatever, wherever he's, California, somewhere that's currently on fire. No, that's a mean joke to make. That's a horrible tragedy. But I'm certainly very surprised by how competent it seems like Alec has been. Not only just at this merge episode, but recently, it seems like even in confessionals, he's very well spoken and he's out there really trying to play the game hard. And that has been, frankly, one of my biggest surprises of these last few weeks.
Yeah, he has the Bradley effect of last season of just sounding like a dick, even when he's just acting like his normal self. And it makes for great television. It's perfect. And Alec, not only is he talking the talk, he's walking the walk as well. Like, we saw him flip on Natalia, which a lot of people were criticizing for, including not just Angelina, but the fan base at large as well. But it seems like that's had no lasting consequences for him, really. And he's been able to maneuver himself into a position where he can go with whatever Davids he likes or with the remainder of the Goliaths. And in that feud between him and Angelina, he's coming across as the more rational and competent one to that group now. Like, she's the one who's now having to justify herself to him instead of the other way around.
I mean, maybe this is a bit of a high bar, but I would love it if we could watch Alec, like, Sangman his way through each of these rounds, just, like, betraying the majority for the sake of betraying the majority.
But this is what I was getting at when I defended that move a few weeks ago, because it's not as simple as David versus Goliath, and this is a point which they have really emphasized and beat into our skulls over and over again. We see Mike saying it, we see Alec saying it, we see Nick saying it. It's not as simple as David versus Goliath, and so, yeah, okay, in theory, he's flipping on the Goliaths, but if he feels better with those Davids, then he can make something work with them, or not, as it turns out, because that group was Elizabeth, Davey, and then Carl would be rejoining them. Elizabeth is gone, we have no idea what Davey's up to, and Carl doesn't seem to have any friends anymore, and yet Alec has emerged completely unscathed, and somehow seems to be in outside of, well, I say outside of like Nick and Christian and Gabby, so somewhere in there, as part of that larger group, he's in a great position, and nothing seems to be really threatening him at the moment.
Yeah, no, I'm very much looking forward to finding out where Alec is going to end up fitting into all this, because it really seems like he, no matter how this plays out, is not going to either be winning or losing quietly in virtually any of these rounds, as far as I can tell. He seems like the type of player who every single tribal council he views as like an opportunity to improve his position in the game. And I never thought I would be saying that about Alec if you had asked me after the first few weeks. But Frank, you know, full disclosure, Dom, that is my favorite type of survivor player. That's why maybe everyone in the cast would be a bit of a it'd be overload. Like, that would be too much in terms of people going out there being like super hardcore game players. And there is something to the idea of a nice balance of play styles. But I absolutely love the initiative that I'm seeing out of Alec to this point.
And yeah, we see Alec reach out to Christian, and yet another of these unlikely friendships starts to form. And this grows and blossoms into the larger Strikeforce alliance. And the way that comes together, it's almost like what we saw with Elizabeth in the first episode, of one person goes and recruits someone else, and then they go and recruit someone in turn, and it all just piles up on top of each other. So like, Alec goes and brings Gabby in, Gabby's on board with Christian, like she really wants him in there, and once again Nick just sidles on in, and everyone seems to take it for granted that, oh, of course Nick's going to be included, even though we don't see that pivotal conversation that cements Nick's place in that alliance. We don't see who brings him in. It's just, oh, well, Nick happens to be here and we all like him, so why not? And that seems to be his MO, right? He's just there and that's good enough.
Well, the fact that we haven't seen him making secret final twos with weird names with every person who's in the Strike Force doesn't mean that hasn't happened already. And they all are thinking to themselves, oh, it'd be, I can't believe all these people in this new alliance also want Nick involved. That'd be great for me.
If Nick does go on to win, which I think is decently likely at this point, I hope the winner's montage is just 10 identical confessionals of everyone talking about how much they trust Nick. The same kind of way we had
Andy
with Andy. Yeah, exactly. That's the perfect example.
Yeah, the, oh my god, 8 people in a row talking about how, oh my god, I can't believe how safe I feel now that Andy's HOH, is one of the all-time, like, classic Big Brother moments. I've said before, like, if you want to sum up BB15 in a 10-second clip, that's all you need to see, is that compilation of everyone else in the house when Andy wins head of household, saying in the diary room, couldn't be more excited about Andy being in charge.
And to go into one of those uncountable separate alliances, Mike, he's already rekindled this Rockstar alliance with Nick, but he's also on maneuvers himself, trying to forge connections with people and playing the same kind of game that Nick is actually at. So it's like Nick and Christian and Mike, and I guess Alec in a way too, are all playing fairly similar games in that sense. So there's going to have to be a collision there at some point, right? They can't all just coexist peacefully. I guess if all four of them are in an alliance together, then they can for the time being. But then when you get down to 8 or 7, let's say, there are going to be a lot of fireworks, I imagine.
This is a thought I hadn't pieced together to this point, but now that I'm here, I actually very much like it. Dom, is Mike White playing the best Andy Heron game of this season?
Possibly, but when I asked you if you find Nick convincing, do you find Mike White convincing? Because I don't. I am not here for Mike White so far, and I don't understand. I don't get it. Can you enlighten me?
Enlighten, like the name of his incredible TV show that he enlightened, that I love and everyone should watch. Incredible unintentional Mike White reference there by you, Dom.
Give me some credit. Come on.
That was not on purpose.
No, it wasn't.
Anyway, I am here for Mike White. I am 100% here for Mike White. I am absolutely buying Mike White. I feel like I totally understand why people around him would be taken by him, especially in this environment. Like, I would say Mike White to me is the you know, what people would always say about Jeremy Collins or like Wendell last season. I got a lot, I think, got a lot of credit for this, of being the guy you can go to who's just going to be reassuring and who you know is going to be calm and level headed and it's going to go well and you're going to feel better at the end of the conversation. I think Mike White has a lot of him there. And I'm, I guess I'm not surprised to find out that you, Dom, hate something that I find so impossible to dislike. But I am absolutely here. I am quite right for Mike White. Well, no. Not good. Not, we'll work on something for Mike White. I'm definitely a Mike White fan.
I think the Eisenhower buttons from the 50s had it right. You like Mike. Just keep it
Mike.
Simple. Yeah.
But there you go.
But it's not that I dislike Mike White. It's that I don't know why I should like him yet. And that's basically okay. My philosophy on most things. It's not that I'm not into them. It's just I don't know why I should be so far. And I want to be convinced. So make the case to me.
Watch Enlightened and you will be convinced.
Well, look, liking someone's work doesn't mean that you like them as a person. As fans of the podcast might agree.
I think everyone listening to this knows a lot about that. Yeah. What more do you need to see out of Mike White? What are you looking for that you're not getting out of what you would have hoped to have seen from Mike by now?
I don't know what I need to see. I guess he is so essentially low-key that he's never going to make such a strong impression. But if people out there are feeling reassured by him, then what? Yeah, why do they care what I think, right? That's all he needs to do. And
right. I mean, so essentially low-key, or whatever word you used, is perfect, right? Is that a bad thing in Survivor?
It's not, but if you need to really make something happen, then maybe you need a bigger force of personality to be the driver behind that and make it work. But for now, he doesn't need to do anything, so why not? But I will say, I do like his manner when it seems like often people are coming to him with complaints about other people, and he has a good way of just validating all of those and like repeating exactly the same thing back, but in a slightly different way, so they feel like he's on exactly the same page as them. And
it's the Dom Harvey effect. It's you take what I'm saying and put it into smart person words and repeat it back to me, and I feel like, oh yeah, that guy gets it.
Or I say it in a dumber way, but with a British accent, so it sounds smarter, and then it works perfectly. Yeah.
That's right. That's exactly right. Even if it's dumb, you have the bailout there. Not bad at all. So yeah, I'm definitely into Mike White and certainly into his position in the game, where with this Strikeforce alliance now, I know it's a 3-3 split, at least on the surface, between former Goliaths and former Davids, but I do feel like Mike White, of those former Goliaths, has got to be in one of the better positions to get in good if some kind of mix of David and Goliaths are going to form the kind of inner layers of that onion.
Yeah, and a point that Kellen made on RHAP this week, which, and she was fantastic there, by the way. I know there were lots of people who said, I wasn't a fan of Kellen on her season, but I found her annoying and so on, but I actually really liked her here. And it's like, well, she's exactly the same person, and it's just the same qualities that you saw there. So like, maybe check why you hated her in the first place. Like, that doesn't really make sense to me, but regardless, she was great. One of the points she made was that when this alliance came together, it's not like Allison, Alec, and Mike, who, as the Goliaths, as the people who are in the majority at the moment and trying to branch out, they can take their pick of the Davids. So if they wanted to go to, let's say, Carl and Davey and bring them in theory, they could do that. It feels like instead they're going for the people who are already in high demand, who are already well-connected and doing pretty well for themselves in Nick and Christian and Gabby. And that kind of makes sense, because if they're well-connected, then you're more likely to already have that bond with them. So you just bring them in and it's a lot easier. You're not starting from scratch in that sense. But it's, you would think down the line, the likes of Carl or maybe Davey, depending on where he's at, might be easier to beat just because they don't have any parachutes. They don't have any other options. But this is, if you look over the past few seasons, I think you see this time and time again, like Millennials versus Gen X, let's say, when you have these constantly shifting alliances, but it seemed like the moving parts in those were always the ones who could go wherever they wanted. Like, it was Adam and Hannah, who seemed to have bonds with pretty much everybody, or David, who became such a big social threat that then people were breaking away from him because he was too well liked, or Zeke, like going back and forth whatever he wanted until he did that too often and he got cut. So it wasn't like the people on the outs were being scooped in and used by other people. They were just left there, and the big power players were just mingling with each other and then turning on each other, and then the outsiders had a front row seat to that almost.
Right. I mean, you hear Adam, talk about millennials versus Gen X, and it does get a lot of credit for having a really dynamic post-merge with a lot of exciting votes. And it, you know, Hannah popularized the terminology of like trust clusters and so forth. But to hear Adam describe it in his mind, like, yes, while those kinds of things were happening, there was never any doubt in any of their minds that this is the alliance. Like, it's the same group of us going back and forth a bit, but we are still loyal to each other, and it will be a while before we start cutting each other down. And I think that could be potentially the case with a lot of the main players in the strike force as well. Like, yeah, there may be some votes that go not exactly in line with what you may have thought coming out of the previous tribal council, but at the end of the season they will probably come away feeling like they were for the most part loyal to each other the entire time.
Yeah, I can see all of them, or at least most of them, being in there for the long haul, and I'm going to be very happy about that, even though this is such a stacked cast that we're going to be, we're going to have some heartbreak moments over the next few episodes. So if these five or these six go together towards the end, but it means we lose John, we lose Angelina, I don't know if that's a price worth paying, but it's a price we might have to pay, and vice versa. Like, if they somehow take control of things again and it ends up being Christian and Gabby who go, well, that's going to be a tough loss to swallow as well.
I mean, I think that is the single best problem you can have. I would truly designate that the Survivor Maryland dilemma of, I don't want to lose any of these people.
Yeah, absolutely right. So let's move on to this immunity here. And this is, you've put in the notes, this is the pendulum swinging challenge from Australia, which I never know how you have a memory for this stuff, but you do. And I'm very thankful for it, because I never would have placed this at all.
That's adorable that you thought I remembered that. No, I saw a tweet telling me that it was from Survivor Australia.
Well, see, once again, I'm being optimistic and wanting to believe the best in you, and you disappoint me time and time again.
That's right. And not disappointing anyone here, though, is Allison, who seems very excited to win this necklace and happy that her family is going to get to celebrate. And I believe it was Kellen who made this point. I listened to at least the first hour or so, couple hours of a very long Kellen interview while I was at poker the other day. Kellen made a good point that I'm sure, you know, has come up over the years on this podcast as well, but I thought it was worth reiterating here. As excited as Allison probably was to win this immunity challenge, and maybe her back was up against the wall and that timeline didn't come in because she got the necklace, who knows, but as far as we could tell, it seemed like Allison did not need this necklace. And Kellen's point was, when she was out there, she was thinking to herself, I am never even going to consider winning any of these individual immunity challenges that I don't feel like I need to win. Is that something that you think, Dom, is becoming more of a factor now on Survivor, now that people really do seem kind of thinking on a new level, at least in the more recent seasons, of kind of like advanced kind of gameplay? I don't know, I'm describing it poorly, but like, now that people really are much more inclined, I guess, to take their own self-interest into their own hands as quickly as possible, is throwing unnecessary immunity challenges more of a priority than it's been in the past?
Yeah, I think you're right. And my worry now is that if Allison gets voted out in two or three episodes, this is going to be the thing that they hinge on to explain why. That, oh, look, she's doing so well in all these challenges, so we have to get rid of her now. She's a physical threat. And this is just setting the stage for that, as opposed to just being an achievement that we can celebrate in its own right.
I do understand the idea of, if Elizabeth is the big target here, you will recall Elizabeth is the person who came in second in this challenge. And maybe it was a situation where Allison was saying to herself, I would love to drop, but if I drop, then Elizabeth could get the necklace, or once it got down to just the two of them, she would know, of course, Elizabeth will get the necklace if I end up dropping now. So maybe she was planning on going out as soon as Elizabeth ended up dropping and just never got the chance.
And I don't know about you, but I really like this challenge, and there's something visually satisfying about just watching people's hopes shatter as their thing just like clangs against the metal over and over again. But it was a little weird how as they exited, Jeff was like, well, you lost momentum, so you're out. That felt like a very, I don't know, uninspiring way of putting that.
Too literal? Like, You literally lost momentum and now you're out of the game.
Is that Charlie and Christian? Like, yeah, the kinetic energy of your pendulum decreased to a certain threshold, and therefore you are now out of the challenge. It just felt, I don't know, it didn't, there was no buzz generated by that.
Can I, not related to this specifically, but along similar lines, about Christian and that kind of, you know, his science brain or math brain coming into play within the game. One scene that I thought was interesting, not even a scene, but just a comment and a reaction to it that I wanted to flag up on the podcast. If you at home want to know how smart people react to being corrected, watch Allison's reaction when Christian says, actually, technically speaking, it's factorials, not exponents. And Allison is so quick to say, oh my God, thank you. I knew I was saying the wrong thing. I'm so embarrassed. You were totally right. There, the difference in how people react to things like that is all you ever need to know about anyone. I swear to you, you will find the smartest people in the world react exactly like how Allison reacted.
So when I correct you and you just yell at me and make me feel inferior for doing it, what should I take away from that?
Case in point, that's all you need to see.
Fair enough. I think Allison knew that, like, okay, I don't care what it is, but I know better than to pick this fight, Hero Tribal, with Christian on national TV. Like, that's doing neither of us any favors.
I don't think she was doing that kind of math. I think she genuinely would, not to make a math joke, like, I don't think she was making that connection. I think she genuinely was like, oh my God, that's so funny. I knew I was saying the wrong thing. Thank you for pulling out the word that I was going for. But I just also think people in Christian's spot often are like ludicrously antagonized for merely trying to be like funny and helpful.
But that's neither funny nor helpful.
I thought it was both. Clearly, look at the reaction.
I guess different audiences react in different ways. But all I'm saying is that there is a fine line between Spencer Reed and Sheldon Cooper, and I think we're getting dangerously close to that line.
Between who and Sheldon Cooper?
Well, if you watch Criminal Minds, like other members of your family, Colin, then you would know. But sadly, I guess not.
Okay, I'm very glad that was from some show I haven't seen instead of some person I've just completely forgotten about.
I still want to do a Criminal Minds podcast with your mom, but I imagine you're still going to use your power of veto on that.
What podcast am I doing with your mom?
Okay, I'm fine. Let's move on.
You give me the show. We can make it happen. Yeah. All right. So, yeah, I'm with you, though. I really liked this immunity challenge. And generally speaking, I know we say this when we occasionally talk about Australian Survivor, but their challenges, for whatever reason, and again, I know they have a lot of challenge people who came up under the wing of John Kierhofer working on the U.S. show, but the Australian challenge department does a really bang-up job over the course of at least the seasons I've seen, keeping their challenges, like, at least feeling fresh, even though it's roughly the same kind of thing going on across the board. It, for whatever reason, feels a lot more exciting to me when I'm gearing up to go watch a challenge on an episode of Australian Survivor versus U.S. Survivor, just because on U.S. Survivor, I feel like I know roughly what I'm going to get, like, a solid 90% of the time, whereas anything, we could be playing charades on Australian Survivor. Literally, there was a charades challenge.
And I wasn't complaining, frankly. Like, it maybe there are more inspired ideas you could use. I'm sure that's not what they're paying you for in the challenge department. But I don't hate it. Like, I'm fine with trying new things.
Yeah. All right. So Allison is our immunity winner here. And I guess the only real kind of decoy situation that we have going on as far as one side wants Elizabeth, up until the point where things are going to potentially get turned on Angelina for a little bit. One thing we should address quickly is Elizabeth and her kind of ploy to split up Dan and Kara. And she feels like this is a power couple that is obviously becoming an issue for all of us. And, you know, if we let them skate by any further, they could be a real problem. And even if there isn't anything romantic going on, it doesn't matter because they're just going to be deathly loyal to each other. And we haven't talked a ton about Dan and Kara and where they fit in to this point. But what have you made, at least based on what little we've seen through the merge so far, of how they may stack up here?
if we're talking about Dan, let's quickly talk about his performance in the challenge, which was one of the genuine high points of the whole episode for me, because his affirmations as his thing was swirling around of keep telling yourself how awesome you are, you are the man. I love that. It's just so earnest, and it's like he's the friend you want cheering you on whenever you're trying hard or something. He's the cheerleader you want, except he's that to himself rather than other people. And it's so perfect.
Yeah, he falls asleep at night listening to Tony Robbins tapes, it sounds like.
Yeah, find someone who treats you the way Dan treats himself, and you know you've got a keeper.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dan still has those two immunity idols in his bag or wherever he's keeping them, in his jacket, I suppose. And Kara knows about the second one now. He goes and tells her, and he seemed very excited about reuniting with her. But I don't know who else Dan, even at this point, feels that great about, other than by, like, after this vote goes down, he may still not even know what kind of jeopardy he could be in relatively quickly after this unanimous vote seems to go his way.
Yeah, and I would say that second idol doesn't seem especially disguised when everybody knows about the first one, right? Because it feels like a somewhat binary thing of either they have an idol and they have a way to protect themselves, or they don't have an idol and we have a free shot at them whenever we can get it. Adding a second idol to that equation, I don't think really changes anything, because if they're playing around one, that effectively plays around two. I guess if Dan could go for some Parvati-esque double idol play, or maybe he like idols himself and Kara at the same tribal or something if he thinks they're going to be a target, but outside of that, his cards are basically face up, I think. Do you disagree, or do you think there's more to it than that?
I don't disagree, and something you just said actually now is making me wonder. I think I am ready at this point to take the over on 0.5 of Dan's idols being played on Kara.
Okay, I like that. Would you say over, under, on 1.5?
Under. I'm not going to say both of them are going to be spent on Kara, but I would say...
Colin, would you say exactly one idol is going to be played on Kara?
Yeah, I'll take the push on one idol. I would say that would be my speculation at this point, and it hadn't crossed my mind until you referenced some kind of Parvati-esque move, but it would not shock me if Dan gets some kind of bad vibes and says to himself, I just want to make sure me and my main squeeze, Kara, are here
I'm
tomorrow night.
I'm thinking Parvati-esque purely in terms of number of idols played rather than the the content or the logic behind it. But maybe I'm giving him too little credit. But we can live in hope.
Okay. Yeah. And as far as Kara goes, we didn't see too much of her in this merge and didn't get to hear a ton of like how she felt about the way the vote was going to go down or whatever, because at a certain point it all became trying to turn the tables on Angelina. But did you have any takes you're dying to get out there about Kara at this point?
Not really. I think she's still playing a pretty solid game, and if anything takes it down, it's going to be just accidentally being tied to Dan. I guess you could fault her for having too good a social game that Dan fell in love with her the moment he set eyes on her, and you know that's going to end up ruining her and dragging her down. But outside of that, it feels like people like her well enough. She's fitting in well. No one's coming after her. She's on nobody's radar at this point. And once again, the only context in which she is seen as a threat is by being tied to Dan, who is maybe going rogue and has at least one idol from what we know about, and is a bit unpredictable. So if she can maybe distance herself from Dan, and it would be amazing if she ends up joining a blindside against him, and then at that point she's safe. I'm pretty sure, like, no one would be coming after her. So that might be the move, actually, if she can engineer a blindside on Dan. I guess being that cutthroat itself makes you a target, but so maybe there's no easy way to escape that bind. Maybe that's just something she has to deal with.
Yeah, I could see it being, if we are going to go with the idea that one of Dan's idols could be used to her benefit, I could see her being the Malcolm and him being the Reynold in this scenario, where she is essentially saying to herself, yeah, it's great. I would love to use whatever idols you have to improve my own situation, but I'm not going to lose a whole lot of sleep if you end up leaving sometime soon.
So which one of them is getting the song parody written about them?
That's a good question. You know, the Lego video taking over the entire Survivor Reddit for a week.
I'm pretty sure Dan already is just a default Lego figure, right? So in terms of logistics, that's probably easier.
I was thinking,
Lego also has just generic blonde as well, so it could go either way.
Yeah, is every Lego a kind of a blonde by default, and then they get weird hair jobs to change it? But I was thinking,
yeah, or by default, all Lego figures are in the blonde dimensional lines.
That's right. Is Dan doing solid work for all future cops on Survivor? Because there was a time, relatively recently, where I remember saying, if you go on Survivor, the jobs you should lie about are lawyer and cop, especially on the heels of Tony Vlachos and Sarah Lucina winning as cops. And of course, Dom, if we want to include the Big Brother universe, Derek Levasseur put on a complete clinic, an undercover detective. And I remember thinking to myself, on the heels of Sarah winning, is it like an unfair advantage in these games to be someone who is professionally trained at the skill set that is among the most important in this? Like, understanding when someone's lying to you and being able to come up with very quick lies to get them back on your side. And now here comes Dan. Now I'm really seriously questioning if, like, sample size was an issue there.
Well, I'm glad we have more data to make a more scientific conclusion.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like he could be doing some favors for all future cops that go out there.
Is this the same way we were saying that, like, Cameron on BB19 was paying the price for Ian Terry and Steve Moses? Is Dan potentially resetting the bar for any future wannabe Tonys or Sarah Lucinas?
That's right. He's doing his greatest public service of all, Dom. I don't know how much to make of any of these kind of, like, decoy scenes that we end up seeing about, you know, Angelina tells Elizabeth she's the target, and then word gets back to Gabby, and she seems to kind of lead this charge to potentially flip the tables, or turn the tables, I guess, back onto Angelina herself. And obviously nothing even close to relevant is going to end up coming of this. And I don't know how close it potentially was on the island, and then they got the word, you know, at the last minute, hey, the critical votes we need aren't going to be there. We got to just go back to the regular plan and take out Elizabeth. But what did you make, if anything, of this kind of decoy situation? Or was it just that, just some kind of compelling decoy?
Well, once again, it hooked me in. I thought Angelina was going, so...
No, in retrospect, I mean, what do you... Is there anything to make of that? Not how much of a fool are you, Dom Harvey? We all know the answer.
I don't think there's anything to add, but clearly I don't know what's going on. So if there is anything, please, by all means, let me know.
No, I don't have a ton to add, and I shouldn't give you too hard of a time, because I certainly was leaving the door open for this potentially getting turned on Angelina, but I was still at Tribal Council at the most generous 80-20, thinking Elizabeth pretty much had to go.
Sure. I don't know what it is that makes me so credulous about the editing nowadays. But maybe it's some, like, reverse overreaction to getting it wrong in past seasons or something. But it's almost fun being in this casual mentality, but I'm taking things at face value at the same time as I'm overanalyzing each and every second of the show. It's a weird spot to be in.
Well, for the last few seasons, I think they have finally shown it took, like, 16 years to get there, but they are willing to balance their range now finally and mix things up. And I think in particular, as things pertain to tribal councils and vote offs, they have gotten very, very strong at throwing me off on a regular basis. This just wasn't one of them, but there have been plenty of times, particularly over these last three or four seasons, where I have been completely stunned by the tribal council results, much more at like a staggeringly higher frequency than ever was the case for the first at least 15 years of the show.
Yeah, and just before Tribal, Angelina is let in on the news that the vote has switched back to Elizabeth officially, and understandably, she's upset, and she wants some kind of explanation, and you might think that she would take, I think it was Alec, up on the offer to just go off in private one-on-one and understand what just happened, but instead she isn't directly confrontational with the group, but she makes her displeasure pretty clear. And I don't know if in that moment she thought there was a chance of switching it back again and actually getting her way and putting her vote down, or if this was something she would have to grin and bear and then try and get Christian out maybe at the next vote instead. And you can see her just making those calculations as she's learning this news for the first time.
Right. And again, I just don't know how much I even want to try to let that influence the way I'm going to like view the rest of the season going forward, just because I guess it's just because the merge vote ended up coming in 12-1. That almost screams to me of like, because they made it look so compelling, like Angela was so close to going, and lemmings like Dom Harvey were so eager to bite on this storyline, for whatever reason, that almost makes me feel like it was even more just kind of pulled out of thin air.
Okay.
Just because it seemed like they went so hard to try to sell how close this was to coming in. And then it comes back 12-1 and nothing. It's hard to, at least for me, really give a lot of credence to this kind of what I would consider just an outright decoy.
So what's the takeaway here? Is it that Angelina has scorched any social capital she once had? Or is it that we needed a decoy and somehow we were able to set up Angelina, but in reality, she's still firmly ensconced within that majority and nothing's going to touch her for the time being?
I think nothing was going to touch her this week. I think there was a very low risk of anything touching her this week, but I am certainly not saying Angelina is a lock to be there for even beyond the next episode, as far as I would be concerned. I think Angelina could have a rough surprise coming sometime soon.
From what we saw, I would say if they had one or two more days for all of this to percolate, then maybe Angelina would have been in the firing line. But for now, it's like, well, we have a vote coming up in a matter of hours. And Elizabeth said in her exit interview, this whole scene where Angelina came to her and then she tried to turn the tables on her, this was all very last minute. So when she gets all this flack for waiting until tribal to try and launch this coup, there wasn't any other option. They were going into lockdown at that moment, so her hand was forced there. But with that in mind, they make the easy vote, which they all agreed on, and now Angelina herself, her position comes into question for the next vote. And then for her knowing that and feeling, I imagine, humiliated and angry after being called out by her own alliance members in that tribal, she's going to fight back against that, and now that's going to turn it into a whole thing.
I think this saga of Angelina struggling to get her way within this big group is going to be something that we return to in future episodes, Dom.
Right, and when Angelina is trying to sweet talk her alliance very gently into going for Christian instead, she is proud of herself for this almost like Albert-esque amateur NLP style persuasion techniques, or Ange Albert Lena if you prefer, which you probably don't, but just throwing it out there in case you do. And it had the same like smarmy quality to it, I guess, of like, you think you're being smart doing this, but none of the people you're trying to have it work on do, and it just comes across as fake.
Yeah. I think Angelina, there are a lot of people, as we've talked through, that I'm very excited to find out where their story is going to end up going. But as far as this very next episode is concerned, I think it's going to be a big, kind of not make or break, maybe make or break is an okay way of putting it, but like a very big inflection point in the game for Angelina. I think how things shake out after everyone gets back from this 12-1 vote, and now as we're running out of kind of easier boots that everyone's going to have not a hard time getting on board with, where do everyone, you know, beginning to think to themselves, where do I kind of stack up as the game becomes more and more serious? I think it's going to essentially come down to who is in Strikeforce versus who is out of Strikeforce. And I think that could be a big wake-up call for Angelina coming very soon.
And when I make the Albert comparison, which will always be a compliment, by the way, coming out of my mouth, because he's a friend of the show and I'm a big Albert fan, it might be that they suffer, or I guess they have the same eventual fate of every single episode, we're going to get this feint out of, well, Albert's going to try and flip and his alliance is going to try and flip on him, and then nothing ever materializes and he just coasts on to the end, and a lot of the suspense hinges on that repetitive storyline over and over again.
So you're a Palbert?
I am a Palbert, yeah. Or there's got to be some Bert-based portmanteau that I can throw in there, but I'm not fast enough. I'm not quick on the draw this time.
All right. Yeah, so definitely excited to find out what goes on with Angelina next week. Now, Dom,
the specifics of that was that Angelina was couching it in military terms and trying to like rally the troops, as I often say, behind her cause and get that sense of solidarity together. And Dan really took offense to that, because, and this is a common thing, I think, when like for cops or ex-military people, when they think that they're their job or their language is like being appropriated for selfish purposes, that really does not go down well at all. And I feel like that has permanently soured Dan on Angelina now.
Do you get the same way when people use philosophy terms in incorrect contexts?
I'm not like making a moral stand on behalf of philosophers everywhere.
All right, I think you should. I think that's the only real commitment to your craft would be to do so. I know philosophers love nothing more than getting bogged down in meaningless debate, so I think that's something you should pursue. Dom, give me, I guess, your thoughts on, or your parting thoughts here for Elizabeth as we end up losing her here at the Merge. Was this a situation where story checked out for you as far as Elizabeth making sense as the Merge boot?
Yeah, definitely. And we threw out a few other candidates for that role of person who everybody is a little bit shifty of. They don't have any real connections, and so they're going to spin their tires and scramble for a bit, but they feel like the default Merge boot. And Angelina actually was going to be one of those for a time. But looking back, Elizabeth fits the bill perfectly, right? And it's really no surprise to see her going here. I will say, though, that she said, "I came here to win Survivor. I didn't come here to get voted out." And then a good 5 minutes later, she's saying, "My goal was to come in and have fun and be myself." And well done, Jeff says. So I like it when people set realistic goals and manage to fulfill them.
Yeah, I remember we talked a little bit about who would be the Merge boot last week. And I also remember saying last week when we were talking about Allison, I said I thought her realistic outcome range was anything other than the Merge boot all the way through anything, not including like Final Four or so. I think right around there, I think, is about her ceiling. But I said she would be the only thing I could see not happening to Allison is being the Merge boot. And as soon as the episode started, as I flagged up at the beginning, seeing her get the obligatory, "Oh my God, here we are at the Merge." And then before she won the challenge and just seeing her doing really well in the challenge, I was thinking to myself as it came down to her and Elizabeth, "Oh my God, Elizabeth's going to win this and Allison is going to be the Merge boot." The one outcome I said was just not on the table.
I was torn between, please just do it to him. And I actually like Allison. I don't want her to suffer just for my own petty vindictive grudge against you and your takes from last week, which you'll have forgotten about in 2 weeks' time.
Do you think, to go back to Elizabeth, that Elizabeth 2.0 is potentially in play?
Maybe for some kind of second chance season, but outside of that, I don't know what theme she really fits into, other than David versus Goliath, I suppose. So if there's a David versus Goliath 2 Electric Boogaloo, then maybe she's on the docket for that. But I don't know. I wouldn't be shocked to see her be like the surprise choice to be the DDL or the Candace. But outside of that, I'm not seeing where she slots in. Do you disagree?
So I think one major thing she has going for her is she is potentially competing for the same spot as Lauren Rimmer, which is no one should have to face that kind of obstacle because Lauren Rimmer is a goddess and will be back on Survivor hopefully very soon.
And also, you can't have too many Lauren Rimmers, even if they're like the bargain bin version of her. So yeah, but the more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, no, I mean, I would be absolutely personally on board with having Elizabeth back. Like, to me, give me an Elizabeth over someone like the Debbie Wanner pure character type 100 times out of 100 as a returnee, where with Elizabeth, I feel like there is plenty we could see from Elizabeth, a returnee that would be different and better than Elizabeth 1.0, whereas with a lot of the people that they end up bringing back, I don't feel like that's necessarily the case. But what I do think Elizabeth has going for her as far as her shot at returning is, and this is going to sound like I'm kidding, I am not kidding, Elizabeth wears a cowboy hat. And I think that is a visually distinctive thing that when, if it's a second chance to, and she's got her cast photo in a cowboy hat, that is going to be a very big plus in her favor. And on, you know, at the reunion of Survivor 40, as they're going to announce the cast of who's going to be on the next one, it's going to be second chance too. Everyone's going to see Elizabeth in her cowboy hat and quickly be able to do the math the same way I've said many times. I think one thing Rupert has going for him is the beard and the tie dye. I think like the visual instant memory is so massive for the CBS casual, and I think Elizabeth has a lot of that going
for her.
So
now that Canadians can go on Survivor and you're buying me a cowboy hat, is there some larger scheme that I need to be aware of here?
I guess so. I guess she's not going to be the only blonde in a cowboy hat on Survivor anytime soon. Dom, can you get at least dual citizenship so you can go on Survivor?
I don't know even if I can get dual citizenship. If I did, it wouldn't be for that. But sure, why not? We'll have that as a stretch goal.
I'll buy you another cowboy hat if you'll wear it on Survivor.
My entire wardrobe will just
you
be cowboy hats.
You have two cowboy hats. And then you could be like Chidi on The Good Place and spend 8 years deciding between which one to wear. That's like fulfilling your destiny as a philosophy grad.
Perfect. Well, just to give some parting thoughts on Elizabeth, I liked her for the time she was on the season. I thought she was a real person, but quirky enough that she stood out and she was different enough to make an impression. She played really hard at the start, gave us that great first vote on the Davis tribe, and she played hard at the end in a desperate bid to save herself. Can't really ask for anything more than that, frankly.
I'm totally on board with all of that. Dom, the only other thing I wanted to get to before the edit zone was, as I mentioned, it seems like, to me, the merge was really the story of Strikeforce coming together, and while we didn't see them deploy their parachutes just yet, I would imagine that they are going to be going into this next episode the group that I will have my eye on as far as who is going to potentially take control now that there are 12 people left. It seems like they've got at least 6 on board there, but what are you thinking about the kind of eventual power alliance that's going to come to fruition here?
So going back to that question of why set these up if nothing's going to happen, I think this is the kind of thing which you can't really bluff or feint in the direction of as easily as stuff like idol finding or whatever. So I expect the Strike Force to, for at least some portion of the game, be in control and be the dominant alliance. And whether there's a counterinsurgency from the Goliath remnants or something after that, who knows? But I think this has legs. I think this is going places.
Yeah, I am with that, and I think that's going to be just kind of the lens with which I approach the beginning of this next episode, and I'm happy to follow them down whatever rabbit holes or whatever trails they want to lead me down in terms of how that may get flipped around. And I would love to see over the course of the season, certainly plenty of kind of shakeups within that. And I'm expecting that will continue to be, the season will stay good and we will get some exciting post-merge kind of votes. But as things stand right now, in the terms I think I put it in earlier, it's just like I'm really just looking at the game in terms of you are either in Strikeforce or you are not in Strikeforce. And I'm guessing, at least for the foreseeable future, that's going to be the rough breakdown politically. And we'll see how that ends up playing out. But Dom, anything else before we get into this week's edit zone?
What did you make of Tribal itself? Because you had Elizabeth buzzing Angelina and then everybody else also buzzing Angelina. It was weird to see, like, Allison, for instance, who seems to be, firstly, on Angelina's side, and that they seem to be pretty tight, and also just a fairly reserved and softly spoken person in general, calling her out in front of everybody, saying, yeah, I think Angelina was just looking for a jury vote. And maybe in Allison's mind, she didn't see that as an aggressive thing to say. It was just a statement of fact, right? And Angelina, if anything, would appreciate that as someone who operates on those terms and who likes that kind of honest, dispassionate analysis, but at the same time, it still was kind of jarring, right? And especially coming off the heels of everybody else criticizing Angelina, I imagine it came across to her as just like piling on and adding fuel to that fire.
Yeah, I thought Tribal, again, I was viewing it essentially through the lens of I'm watching the editors, as far as I can tell, in their defense, doing what they should be doing and trying to talk me into this being Angelina leaving. And again, while I was watching it, I wasn't like 100% sold, okay, it's got to be Elizabeth. I was still not on the edge of my seat, but still open to the idea that it could be Angelina and I could be the dumb liberal, to put it in secret Hitler terms, I guess, where I'm just wildly overconfident about the wholly wrong idea, which would not be a new experience for me. But in this case, and maybe it was just the reinforcement of seeing the vote go down so decidedly in that way, I, again, did not want to read, frankly, too much into the minutiae of Tribal Council, because it seemed like almost an obligatory effort and a job well done, but of making it seem like Angelina was in far more trouble than she was in.
So where do you think she stands going forward then? Because I said before that for someone like Angelina to win, her entire ability to get things done and then to get people to vote for her depends on being seen as this like competent leader who's always professional, always in control, always has a finger on the pulse of what's going on, and doesn't have the air of desperation that just instantly erodes all of that. But that's what we saw, I think, at this tribal. And I'm wondering now if it's even possible to recover from that. And as a result, might Angelina actually be the perfect goat at this point in the game?
That's not actually a bad take, because I do think Angelina, like, well, I said earlier, I don't think she's coming across as nearly like as bossy as the way the show, at least in this episode, probably was trying to make her look, in terms of it's got to be this way. Oh, no, you're not thinking in your own best interest if you're not lining up with what I want to do. While I don't think it is to that extent, I do think the people in her alliance, even the people who like her and trust her, cannot possibly look at Angelina and see anyone other than an obviously self-interested person who probably at the end of the day is not going to prioritize anyone's interests above her own. And that is, you know, it's hard to give off, it's hard for anyone to not come across that way when they are actually thinking in those terms. But for Angelina in particular, I think she, more so than probably most, is not doing necessarily the best job at disguising how overtly interested in pursuing her own best interests she is. And I think she's playing against people who can do the math that, okay, come day 34, that's going to mean she's totally happy to blindside me.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's where I would be on Angelina, is I think she's in a decent, a okay spot for now, but I would be very surprised if over the course of this post-merge, she's able to like ingratiate herself in and earn everyone's trust and not be viewed as a threat. I think it would take pretty remarkable circumstances for Angelina, or frankly, anyone who really presents themselves like Angelina does in the context of Survivor, to do that well without a lot of people seeing it coming and being willing to get nip that in the bud before it becomes an issue.
I've always wondered if there's a possibility of building your own goat, almost, when you have someone like Angelina who thinks they might be on the outs, and you give them that impression, and you foster that as much as you can, and you see them twist in the wind, and you see them desperately scramble and maybe damage the perception of them in the process by what they have to say and the way they have to treat other people, just to maximize their own chance of staying as they see it. And then you keep them in the game, you rescue them. So firstly, you can take credit for having kept them in the game. They're dependent on you. And now they've also ruined their own reputation to such an extent that now you have a person that you can take to the end and maybe more reliably get votes against.
Yeah, and Angelina honestly seems like a solid candidate for that kind of make your own goat, build a goat, kind of build a bear, but build a goat.
Sure.
All right. Dom, let's hit the edit zone unless you have anything else.
So for all the people who are tuning out right now, and for all the people who are staying here, keep telling yourself how awesome you are. You are the man or woman or whatever other term you feel is appropriate. You are awesome, and keep affirming yourself and know that that's the truth.
All right. Let's take a look at my vision, our vision, in the edit zone. You are listening to the
Dom and Colin Edit Zone.
Mike Holloway,
Michelle Ken,
Brad Culpepper,
David Goliath.
You are listening to the
Dom and Colin
Edit Zone.
What are you doing?
Tune out now. Okay, here we are in the edit zone. Now, Dom, this week was a big week for me, as the merge is usually going to be as far as like the edit is concerned. I know historically the merge generally regarded as one of the more, if not the most important episodes, along with like the premiere over the course of any season. And this merge, to me, I came away with a couple of kind of sweeping takeaways, and the biggest one is this. I feel that as far as winner candidates are concerned, I truly don't know how I would rank these people, but for me, I am down to a big three, and you tell me if you disagree, but I would say at this point, I would say three of these people have a solid 85-90% combined equity for me. I don't know how it's split it up yet. We can maybe talk that through, but for my money, I would say Christian, Nick, and Kara are easily my three biggest front runners. What do you think about that?
I like it. I thought you were going for Nick, Christian, and maybe Gabby, but it sounds like you've changed your tune on her.
Yeah, we'll get to Gabby shortly. But I think Nick, Christian, and Kara, Nick and Christian, for much more obvious reasons, are looking way better than the rest of the pack at the end of this merge. And the reason that I'm including Kara in there is, as has been, as far as I can tell, like the theme of her entire season, she's not really that involved, but we're still seeing plenty of Kara, and she constantly seems to be looking great in every scene she's in. And it's really just the Michelle Fitzgerald logic coming back to haunt us, I guess, of if it were anything other than a very vital player in the season, often specifically only the winner, Kara is the exact kind of player that they would have no issue completely leaving off the show. The reason that I have these as like my big three is it does still seem to be the case to me that for the eventual winner, they are very reluctant to show outright flaws from that person. And these three to me still really stand out above the pack. And that brings me to the other candidate that you had, Dom, and that is Gabby, who we have talked in great detail about over many previous edit zones about how it seems like she's off to kind of a rough start, but hey, this is David versus Goliath. There's still time to turn it around. She's still getting plenty of solid content weaved in there. And this week, you know, we spent a great deal of time talking about how good of a job she did at the merge, noticing that clue. It looks like she's going to be potentially the one who comes up with that advantage or idol or whatever it is there. But Dom, let me direct your attention to this Tribal Council. And this was the scene that really stood out to me from Tribal Council. And more so than whatever bullshit was going on about, hey, maybe it's going to be Angelina. To me, the defining takeaway from all of Tribal Council was the scene of Gabby, where she was talking about how, of course, Elizabeth, when she finds out she's on the bottom, is just going to want to play and she's going to want to do things to help her side. And how could you blame her for that? And throughout the course of this, the course of this scene, Gabby is constantly like wiping away tears and raising her voice and saying, you know, obviously, and things like that. To me, I was willing to go with the Gabby may still be drawing live idea up through Tribal Council. As of this scene at Tribal Council, I am willing to say it, at least for me, the Dunn chain looms heavy around the neck of Gabby Pascuzzi. To me, that is, as I was just saying, about how unwilling they are to show eventual winner's flaws. Gabby is the eventual winner. Getting this scene at Tribal Council is not at all consistent to me.
Why do you see that scene as a game-breaking flaw then?
Because Gabby, the future winner of this season, would come across so composed in that moment. They would take different stuff. They cut back, I counted, three different times to her wiping away tears and like flicking them on Angelina and repeatedly raising her voice and so forth. The eventual winner of this season never looks like that.
I guess the only exception would be like Sophie Clark, kind of, but even that was a very odd exception with, you know, other contextual things around it. But why is it a change now versus the other four scenes we've had in back-to-back-to-back episodes of Gabby crying and reacting that way to things?
Because every single one of those I've come in and said, I'm willing to leave the door open, but it's got to change soon. And now that we have hit the merge, and it seems like they're just leaning even harder into that direction at the most intense moments where like where the emotions really are the highest and like the pressure is most on, what we are seeing from Gabby is Gabby crumbling under that pressure, as far as I can tell to this point. Now that it is at the merge, the very important merge episode, that to me is, if this was going to turn, we would be turning by now, right?
Yeah, and this is where I keep coming back to the question of how real the tears are and how much of it is some kind of manipulation, because you can understand all the previous examples we've seen through the lens of, well, yeah, if you have this deep personal sense of isolation and fear and paranoia and you think that people are out to get you and you don't know if you fit in, you can understand why that would provoke such an emotional response. In this case, though, when it seems like she doesn't have any real personal investment in what she's saying. There's no one event or moment that would bring up that kind of emotion. And yet you still have the tears as like a regular musical accompaniment almost. That's when it starts to feel like it's being put on for show. But I'm not sure what that would be meant to accomplish. I don't know how that helps to drive the point home or make her seem more sympathetic. And you've seen the risk with Sugar of when people can't tell if you're crying because you're actually in that mental state or because you're trying to accomplish something. And you can balance that range perfectly, and it's going to make everybody hate you at the end. So I don't know what it would be working toward, which makes me think it's more likely to be real, but then I don't know how that would come about. So I'm still of two minds there.
So are you still leaving the door open for Gabby, the eventual winner?
I think that door is shut now.
Okay, yeah. To me, it really was that tribal council scene where I could talk myself into it for the first 6 3/4 episodes, but I really just, having seen as much Survivor as I've seen, that back and forth exchange at tribal council, the feeling, the vibe of that was just not at all like anything I've seen from anywhere.
Yeah, it would. There is a first time for everything, but that first time has to come about for a reason, and I'm not sure what the reason would be in this case.
Right, and again, it just goes back to the what I've been saying about Gabby since the premiere, or right around, I guess this, from the premiere, she was my front runner. But since episode 2, what I've been saying about Gabby is just like, it just seems like, based on every other thing I've seen from Gabby off the TV show Survivor, they would have no issue at all making Gabby look totally composed and like she has her shit together 24/7 if they wanted to. And instead, we are getting every single week a scene, at least one scene of Gabby.
Yeah, I doubt that Gabby has been a hot mess continuously for 25 days. I'm sure there have been times right. where she's had more composure, and you could use those if that's the impression you want to give. And if it is going to be constant waterworks, I'm sure you can find a clip of Gabby saying, okay, well, I'm putting this on as a strategy in order to do this, which I'm sure some people still wouldn't like, but they would at least understand. Whereas this, those people are going to write off anyway, and for the wider audience, it's just going to come across as weak in air quotes or in some other negative terms.
Yeah, so I am leaving Gabby out of that big pantheon of the real front runners for me, and as mentioned, I unfortunately at this point I'm ready to go full Dunshane on Gabby, as upsetting as that is. The one person that I think out of the rest of the pack though who would still have some equity for me, my boy, the man you hate, Mike White. Are you still seeing that as a possibility at all?
I haven't. So to adapt a phrase from earlier, it's not that I think it can't happen. I just don't know why it would happen.
Okay, I understand what you're saying there. I just feel like at this point, we've seen enough of Mike White, and virtually everything other than him looking for the idol on day one has been good as far as I can tell. It really seems to me like Mike, and I don't just say this because I'm a huge fan of Enlightened. I really get the impression, like I made the comparison to Andy Heron earlier, like Mike's natural instincts for this game seem spot on. And I feel like Mike, under the right circumstances, could absolutely be a Survivor winner, and I'm not going to rule this out as those potential circumstances. It seems like he's in good with a lot of people, including everyone in the strike force. He's the one getting the setup, talking about how, okay, obviously the Goliaths are eventually going to crumble, and I need to make sure that when that happens, these people are on my side and these votes are going my way. If it weren't for such good edits from other people, I would absolutely see Mike in like a hypothetical different season getting kind of like a winner edit as far as I'd be concerned. I really feel like the vast majority of what we've seen from Mike has been really strong.
The issue with Mike is that he doesn't really display any kind of emotional range, so it's hard for him to articulate this great inspiring journey of all of these ups and downs and to really see the path that he takes to the end. So I think if he were to make it would be the same kind of content that we're getting already. These just mostly low-key, generic, unremarkable confessionals. We'd just be getting 3 times as many of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can definitely see that. Like, I think in a scenario where Mike White, who is so has such a way with words, and sidebar is apparently, you know, pretty good friends with Jeff Probst, and I would imagine knows some of the producers on the show as well, I could see that being kind of like an older Cochran situation where he just kind of holds our hand through this season as he dominates it. All right. And so the other possible kind of single-digit percenters here, Dom, that we could have in the mix. And this is something that came to us in an email this week from Wes. And I, of course, do not have that email pulled up, unfortunately, in front of me. But the gist of the email is essentially the concept of a guy we've talked a little bit about earlier, Alec, who's been looking really good lately, potentially being in the mix here. Now, the issue that we've flagged up since the, you know, the beginning of the season is Alec was just nowhere to be found during those early episodes. And we also know that Alec has not necessarily done himself many favors outside the game as far as production would be concerned. And maybe that could play into this. But is it possible that we are getting like a Kaiser Soze kind of thing? A kind of edit between either Alec or I would also add potentially Allison into the mix here could fit in here as well, where they're just nowhere to be seen during the early days, but they gradually get rid of that limp, and by the end of the movie, they're the ones
well,
taking
I
over.
Do have that email up in front of me because I prepare for this.
Oh, good.
Things.
Good work.
And you got the gist of it pretty much spot on, so congratulations. I would say with Allison, I don't know why they would hide it, because maybe this is just me speaking as an Alice Stan who sees a lot to like in Allison, but
a Palison?
Sure, why not? But with how positive the reception was to her, at least preseason, like I think that's what you can expect reliably from the audience towards her. Like, why would anyone dislike Allison? She seems perfectly likable, perfectly good at pretty much everything. So I don't know why you would hide her when you have a gift to you as a as an editor of having a winner with such just like natural default likability.
Yeah, I mean, I remember you said in one previous podcast that under different circumstances, you could see the entire like Survivor universe comparing Allison to Kim Spradlin.
Right, and they did preseason. So,
and then she's delivering on it.
I hope. I want them to be right about that, and I want to not be wrong because I didn't doubt Allison. It's just I didn't leap on that train immediately, but I wish I had.
Yeah, I would love the idea of a kind of Kaiser Soze Survivor winner. And I guess we sort of have gotten that in the past, like famously the dog that didn't bark and Tina, you know, being the only person who didn't get a premiere confessional. And we've certainly seen plenty of under edited winners, to say the least. But I don't know that Allison or Alec would be a really compelling candidate from that, from the perspective of the editors. I feel like as you were saying, Dom, these are pretty easy people as far as the values that Survivor tends to seem to want to kind of advocate for to, like if one of these two were to win, I don't know that they would have any real reservations about making that one of the more prominent storylines rather than trying to trick the audience for some random reason for the first time in 37 seasons. But hey, like you said, there is potentially a first time for everything. And I guess along similar lines to that concept, Dom, my boy Davey got absolutely nothing here in this merge. Like literally was barely on screen, no confessionals, no anything. But we have seen in rare cases winners be quite quiet at the merge. I'm thinking, I believe Denise Stapley had a pretty low key merge. I think Natalie Anderson, I want to say, had a pretty low key merge. Is there still hope for Davey?
So I will say on Alec quickly, he's a fascinating case. And I was fully expecting Purple Alec. I thought he was going to be just completely written out of the show. And instead, he's made himself one of the major characters. So maybe that's his way of, that's his fuck you statement to them again, just like forcing them to make to give him some kind of presence. But yeah, he's definitely shown up more than I expected, and I've enjoyed him more than I expected, so fully on board the Alec train. I don't think it's going to lead to a win, and I don't know how that would be possible given this external stuff, but I want to at least entertain the possibility because it's a fun one to think about. So as for Davey, yeah, Natalie Anderson famously had that very quiet merge, which led us and other people to write her off, because I felt proud of myself for saying, like, episode 4, episode 5, Natalie's one to watch. Pay attention to Natalie, when it seemed like people weren't saying that. And then I immediately just dismissed myself 2 episodes later when she had this, what I thought was a bad merge episode. And then it took me some time to come around again. And I think in that case, I can't remember what we said at the time, but I think the consensus was, in retrospect, they did that because knowing that this whole Josh versus Jeremy thing was soon going to collapse entirely, and in the ruins of that, we'd have the Natalie revenge storyline with John Mish, there's no reason, like, why build her up now when everything's going to change so soon? Why create this false perception of her in the game when you're going to have to then work to overturn that and reshape that? When instead you can just have people forget about her for now, and then suddenly it's, oh, who's this? It's Natalie suddenly looking like the most badass player in the game out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I don't know how directly that would translate over here, though. I don't know why you would hide Davey. I don't know what Davey has in store from here. So it is curious. I don't think it completely writes them off, but if you're going to write one person out of the show, why would it be Davey when... I guess I don't have another candidate for it other than Mike White, maybe. But anyway, there are other people who you would choose before Davey, I imagine.
Yeah, Davey seems like, when they let him on the screen, to be a ton of fun. And I'm guessing that this is more of an outlier, and that for however many episodes Davey's going to be still in the game, we will generally get to see more of Davey. And I think the devilish Davey kind of persona is not an accident, where I am anticipating at this point Davey being involved in some kind of situation where he's going to either have some sort of opportunity to make some big move, and it's either going to go well or backfire, or he's going to be the victim of some kind of big blindside or try to make some play and have it all blow up in his face. I feel like Davey, there's going to be some kind of big event surrounding Davey in some way, and it's going to be a ton of fun. But unfortunately, after such a quiet merge, as much as he is my favy, I'm also ready to hang the dun chain around
Davey. Yeah, I am looking forward to the Davey Boo episode. That's going to be a good one, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. All right, and I guess the only other person I thought would be interesting to get into is John, who we've seen recently talking primarily about, like, the Brochacho Alliance, and he was pretty visible during the pre-merge and someone that I've had my eye on. But at this point, I would say I would really have expected to see more out of John, and just combined with the fact that he does not seem to be in this Strike Force group, I think really kind of rapidly declining for me. What do you think about
John? Is it possible we've just been overstating the quality of his edit and maybe his game the entire time, and we're just realizing that now?
That we've been overstating it? Yeah, I think that's absolutely possible, that we're reading too much into it. Although I think that kind of, like, Ken McNichol hero scene bringing fish to the beach kind of gives some reason to be keep your eye on John as far as being a long-term player. And I'm absolutely not ruling John out from being a long-term player. I just think at this point it is now capped for me at losing finalist instead of winner.
Do you think that's what's going to happen, or just it could happen still?
I think it could happen, and I think it's not entirely unlikely, the idea of John making it very deep. But I would probably say it's a little less likely now than I may have entering this merge, now that I've seen this Strike Force group form. Because, as I said, we've really seen John just talking about the Brochachos and how there may need to be a Brochacho blindside of Dan coming up soon. I'm wondering if there may eventually be a Brochacho blindside of John as well.
Interesting. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, all right. Anyone else you think is worth diving into?
Haven't we covered everybody?
We may have. Oh, no, we haven't talked. Let me ask you about someone. I'm actually going to say my front runner to be the Kaiser Soze candidate, if one such person is going to exist. Wild Carl bitches, yeehaw. How about Carl being in there in the mix? As we talked about a little earlier, it really seems like he's eager to play, so why not?
Carl Soze?
Yeah, nice. Yeah, that's absolutely what I would be here for. So do you feel like like Davey, I feel like Carl is going to have some kind of fun role to play at some point. I just am not sure how much win equity I'm willing to give him yet.
Yeah, I don't think Carl's a winner, but I don't need him to be to love him anyway.
Yeah, I'm very excited for Carl whenever he gets to be a juror giving stern looks back over to the people still in the game. Yeah, all right, Dom. I think that's going to do it for this week. Let's get out of here. He is, of course, on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. You can email the show, domandcolin@gmail.com. If you have email questions, like we got to a couple of this week. And then I promise next week I will make a better effort to have your email open when it's time to talk about it. So domandcolin@gmail.com. And, of course, Heroes versus Villains Rewatch. Actually, almost at the finale now. Episode 12 is in the books. We only have 13 and 14 left before we are on to a new season of Classic CBS Reality over on Patreon. You can get those episodes every Saturday at patreon.com/Dom and Colin. And at this point, there has got to be at least 25 hours of Heroes versus Villains content alone. So if you are interested in supporting the show and getting a ton of stuff you haven't heard yet, that is the place to be, patreon.com/Dom and Colin. All right, Dominic, anything else before we head out?
I'm good. I'm done.
All right, I am done as well. We will talk to you guys very soon. Take care, everybody.